I am, as Juan said, I'm a grad student at Princeton, and I'm advised by Frank Pretorius. And the work that I'm going to talk about here was also done in large part with Elias Most, who is at Princeton currently, but will be at Caltech in the fall. And I want to talk specifically about dissipation in relativistic fluid theories, which is kind of a nuanced topic, I think. And when I say dissipation, I mean effects like viscosity and heat conduction. Okay. So a nice place to start is with the sort of obvious question, what is a fluid? And the sort of elementary school answer to this question is that a fluid is a liquid or a gas. And this idea sort of comports with our usual terrestrial intuition. And we can sort of see the same sort of patterns arising. We look at liquids and gases. Here I have liquid and gaseous water. And we can see that in both cases, they're forming some sort of vortex-like pattern. So it's not too far-fetched to believe that these things are described by roughly the same physics in some respects. Okay. So this elementary school definition breaks down if you look at sort of what modern physics considers a fluid, because there are also some exotic examples, a couple of which I want to talk about in particular, which are things like the quark-gluon plasma, which is formed in Earth on Earth when you smash a couple of heavy ions together. Oh, sorry. Hello? Okay. Hello? Yeah, sure. Is that better?
Is it better or?
Hello?
No, 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 it did not get better.
Oh.
Hanging in the background as if the microphones pick up something from other parts of the room.
Okay. So I'll try to speak louder. Hopefully that will help a little bit. I'll continue. So one of the things I'm interested in is exotic fluids. And an example of that is the quark-gluon plasma, which is formed when you collide heavy ions in particle accelerators. And also things like neutron star matter, which is typically modeled in simulations as a sort of blob of fluid. Okay. So if you look at these four things, you can see sort of series of substances which seem on the surface very fundamentally different. So a natural question to ask is, why exactly are these things fluids? How, in what sense can we apply fluid mechanics to them? And the way to sort of address that question is by looking at sort of the microscopic origins of what defines hydrodynamics. So here I have a nice GIF of sort of a classical simple gas. So this is an ideal gas. And if you look at the system, it's characterized by two length scales. One of them is the mean free path between particle collisions, which I'm going to call this little script L. And the other one is sort of the size of the system, which is sort of the size of this window here. I'm going to call that capital L. Okay. Now, the thing that physicists love to do is to define dimensionless quantities from dimensional quantities. And a way to do this is to define that sort of microscopic interaction length scale over the macroscopic system scale. And that's called the Knudsen number. And here it's roughly of order unity. So you can see these particles travel a pretty sizable percentage of the distance across this window before colliding. Okay. So you can see that this system, which is characterized by an order unity Knudsen number, has many degrees of freedom. So if you wanted to evolve the system forward in time, in principle, you would need to know the positions and momenta of all of these particles. And you'd have to track collisions, and it would be very hard. So there are many degrees of freedom. And this is sort of a very complicated system in that respect. So fortunately, things simplify pretty significantly if you zoom out. So all we're doing here is we're zooming out on this classical ideal gas. And we're looking at something like this cloud here, where that microscopic system is a tiny, tiny little point, which is smaller yet than some relatively macroscopic size, but still small, element of this cloud, okay? Now you can see that the cloud is characterized by the same microscopic description, so the mean free path is still the same, but you have a much larger macroscopic scale, so the dynamics that you're interested in on this scale are much larger. And as a result of that, you can define a Knudsen number for this system, and it's way smaller, so you have something that's much less than unity. Okay, so if you look at now the dynamics of a small piece of fluid elements of this big macroscopic system, it looks almost homogeneous. In fact, you can pretty accurately describe its behavior by just a handful of bulk properties, things like the density, the temperature, and sort of the net flow velocity. Okay. And these things are pretty much constant within a fluid element of some size. So this sort of system lends itself to a sort of continuum simplified average description whose state is given, state and evolution is given by hydrodynamics. So the idea is essentially that if you compare these two systems, one of them has a very large Knudsen number, the small scale microscopic system. And because of that, it has many degrees of freedom, fluctuations are large, and it's intrinsically very complicated. But at very large scales, these microscopic degrees of freedom average out, and your local fluctuations are much smaller. Okay, and this is the sense that we can apply hydro to these exotic relativistic systems, in that there are some microscopic interactions that are happening there, but on macroscopic scales, most of those microscopic degrees of freedom average out, and you are able to apply some sort of simplified average macroscopic model which describes hydro. Okay, so the statement I have here is that the applicability of hydro reflects the separation of scales intrinsic to your problem. Okay. So I mentioned this is a talk on relativistic fluids. And the reason that we are interested in these sorts of things is that they probe the most extreme temperatures and densities. So if you want to see really interesting physics, you have to probe regimes that are not visible to us in everyday life. And here, we're interested in a couple of those systems, quark, gluon, plasma, and neutron stars. And we can see on this phase diagram, quark gluon plasma as produced in labs at places like the Large Hadron Collider and the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider in those ovals are at very, very high temperature, hot enough to sort of melt hadrons into this quark gluon plasma. But they're at very low densities. And neutron star matter lives sort of in a complementary region of this phase diagram at very low temperatures in some respects, but very high densities. Okay, so if you want to see interesting physics, you have to go very far from the everyday life type situation, and this is definitely doing that. So in these regimes, our microphysics is not completely understood. And if you want to sort of understand a system where the microphysics is not completely understood, you need some kind of model that can incorporate some of the microphysics, but does not require all of it to be known in order to make some prediction for the bulk dynamics of the system. And fluid mechanics is precisely that. So you can build a fluid model without having the full microphysical theory, and then you can sort of tweak it and compare to experiment or some other observation to slowly learn more and more about the microscopic physics that you're interested in. Okay? So sort of adding title word by word in my title, I'm talking about dissipation in particular here. And dissipation is definitely required to accurately model the quark gluon plasma. Here I have a little movie of a quark gluon plasma simulation. And what happens here is you have a couple of nuclei in a particle accelerator. You smash them into each other, and you can see that they're Lorentz contracted to look kind of like pancakes in the beginning there. They smash into each other, and there's so much energy in this collision that your nuclei sort of melt into this quark gluon plasma phase, which has a bunch of sort of rainbow colors here. That will grow, and it will cool as it grows and expands. And then eventually, it'll cool to the point where it hadronizes. It'll form hadrons again. And then those hadrons fly off and are picked up by some detector. And if you want to try to model this accurately and model that distribution of detections accurately, you need shear viscosity in this fluid phase, in addition to relativistic effects, to get that right. Okay, and this is experimentally determined and is pretty well known. Now, there are some limited indications that similar dissipative effects could be important in neutron star mergers. So here I have a part of a figure from a very recent paper from one of my collaborators. It's from 2022. And the claim is that nuclear interactions in binary neutron star mergers can produce essentially an effective bulk viscosity, which contributes at the level of about 10% of the total pressure. So this is sort of one of the motivations that these are the two systems I've kind of referenced for the rest of this talk as places where you may need relativistic fluid models with dissipation. Okay, and it probably would help. So shear viscosity is a resistance to shearing in the flow. And bulk viscosity is a resistance to expansion and contraction of the flow. Okay. So here I'll give a little outline for the rest of the talk. That was sort of an intro and motivation. And then I'm going to talk about how you construct a relativistic fluid theory with dissipation. Properties of a particular one, which I'm going to call BDN. Sorry? When you start the shear of a bulk. So it's believed that bulk will be much larger and shear will probably not be detectable. But it's like they're very early in the process of learning about those sorts of effects. So this is the part I'm going to talk about next, is constructing a fluid model. And then after that, I'll talk about BDNK theory, which is a specific example. I'll talk about progress toward astro applications like that binary neutron star merger. And finally, I'll talk about some future work that we could do. All right, so we want to construct a fluid theory, and there are sort of two ways you can do this. The first approach I want to talk about is you imagine you completely know your microscopic physics. If that's the case, getting your hydro model is just a matter of averaging out the short wavelength modes. It's just some averaging procedure you're applying, and that should give you everything. That should give you your full hydro model. Okay? So there are some famous non-relativistic examples of this by Hilbert, Chapman-Enskog, Burnett, and Grad. And in particular, I want to talk about Chapman-Enskog, because the game that they wanted to play, this is the early 20th century, the idea was that we had, all of a sudden, a nice classical model of the microphysics. We had the Boltzmann equation. And the idea was we also had a couple of nice fluid theories. We had the Euler equations, which describe an inviscid non-relativistic fluid. And we also had the Navier-Stokes equations, which describe a viscous non-relativistic fluid. So the game that Chapman-Enskog played is they wanted to sort of approximate the Boltzmann equation in some way, such that when you average out the short wavelength modes, you get those fluid theories, the Euler equations and the relativistic and the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation. So the approach there was to take the particle distribution function, which tells you how particles are distributed in position and momentum space, and which goes into the Boltzmann equation. And they wanted to sort of expand this in some parameter, and they chose the Knudsen number that I mentioned before. Now, when you do this expansion, you can compute hydro by averaging it. And when you average it, you can keep a certain amount of physics here, certain order up in the Knudsen number. So if you do this at zeroth order, Chapman-Enskog find that you recover the Euler equations, which is a nice first step, and they have no dissipation built into that theory. Now, if you keep up to linear order in the Knudsen number, you get the Navier-Stokes equations, which give you viscosity. And then finally, if you go higher order, you get what are called the Burnett and super-Burnett theories, which are not nearly as famous as the Euler and Navier-Stokes theories, but they also are worth knowing about because it tells you that you can play this game. You can increase the amount of physics you incorporate into your microscopic theory before the averaging process happens, and it gives you different fluid theories with different amounts of physics in them. Okay? So this is a nice example. And then there were a couple further procedures that took different expansions of the microphysics of the Boltzmann equation. One of them was by Grad, and that approach was generalized in the relativistic context by these authors here, whose theory is known as DNMR theory. And that's sort of the common prevailing theory used to model quark gluon plasma. And this theory has that connection to experiment and appears to work well. Okay, so that's one approach. So a second approach is you suppose that you don't, yes?
Yeah, sorry. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So perhaps basic question, but sometimes when you try to model radiation, you also take some approximation to Boltzmann equation. So it's not clear, but how would you compare that usual procedure with this approach? Is the same expansion or is it similar?
That's a good question. So I'm not familiar with that, but there are multiple different expansions you can take. And not everyone uses the expansion that Chapman and Enskog use. So Chapman and Enskog expands in terms of, essentially in terms of order power of the Knudsen number. There are other expansions, and this one which I mentioned, this DNMR theory, they use expansion in moments. There are a number of different ways you can do this, and depending on what method you use, you get a different fluid theory. That's my understanding.
Just a question, because people are familiar with the non-relativistic one, so what's the big gap in understanding between relativistic and non-relativistic?
Good question.
Free thermodynamics.
So I think that...
you mean about the relativistic uniquely, right?
I will talk about the relativistic soon.
So far it's too general. Okay.
Yeah, so sorry. I think maybe I'll come back to that in a second.
Okay, is it something very non-relativistic? That's why I'm asking.
So there are some fundamental differences, and I think I should get to them. So, but ask me again if I miss something.
Thanks.
Okay, so another way you can do this is instead of assuming that you know your microphysics and performing this average, what you can do is you can apply some sort of effective field theory argument to write down the hydro equations, these macroscopic equations you want to solve, and then you can use some other method to sort of pick up and specify the unknown coefficients that appear when you apply this effective field theory approach. Okay, and that other method can be, there are a lot of different options. One of them is matching. If you know some aspects of your microphysics enough to calculate coefficients, you can do that, or maybe you have to leave some of them as sort of free parameters. You could use experiment if you have that. And then there are some other approaches, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And the sort of effective field theory method has a couple of relativistic examples, which are probably familiar to those of you who are in this field. One of them is Muller-Israel-Stewart theory, which I'm going to abbreviate MIS. That sort of uses this effective field theory approach and then solves the Boltzmann equation in a certain way to get coefficients. There's also this method, which is very recent, by Benfica, Descanzi, Neronia, and Compton, which I'm going to abbreviate BDNK. And that's what I'm going to talk about primarily here. This is very recent, past few years. Okay? So I'm going to use that EFT approach to try to construct this hydro theory. And this EFT approach starts essentially in two principles. The first of these is that your equations of motion are given by a set of conservation laws. So if you assert that your system has some conservation of energy and momentum, then you get this conservation law for the stress energy tensor, which is the first equation. And then if you also have some sort of conserved particle number, you get a conserved baryon current. If it's baryons or some other kind of particle, you have a conserved particle current for whatever species of particles that may be, and that's that second equation. Okay. And the second idea is that you're building a macroscopic model here, so you want to parameterize it using some sort of macroscopic observables, and thermodynamics gives you a nice set of those. And here in particular, I'm going to use these three. This U is a time-like four velocity for the flow. Epsilon is an energy density, and then N is a particle density. Okay? So we have these two ideas. And then a little point I should make is that if you look in the literature, they don't always use this set of parameters. Sometimes, instead of using the energy density and the particle density, they'll use the laws of thermodynamics to exchange these for things like the temperature and the chemical potential. So that's a little bit of a minor point. So this is the general idea. And before I continue, I'm going to do a little bit of a simplifying assumption just for the sake of not having to write complicated equations. And we're going to specialize to what are called conformal fluids. And ultimately, what this means practically for the rest of the talk is that we're going to look at a fluid where the stress energy tensor is trace-free. And this assumption that we're at zero chemical potential has the effect of decoupling the baryon current, this J, from our stress energy tensor and removing the dependence on that particle density from the stress energy tensor. So in essence, if you're not interested in evolving this particle density, you can focus just on the stress energy tensor. And we will do this here. And we'll essentially just have one conserved current, just the stress energy tensor, and that is the entire fluid theory. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this effective field theory approach to define the stress energy tensor in terms of these parameters.
Sorry, I have a question. Suppose that the number of particles is not conserved in this process, so suppose you don't have another conserved current J. Mm-hmm. In that case, if you require that the energy tensor is traceless, not only you get that the couples, right, but you also get the relationship between energy density and the pressure of the fluid.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll get to that.
Okay, thanks.
So the game that we're going to play here is we're going to try to define the stress energy tensor in terms of these two parameters, which is simple enough. So the EFT approach essentially says that we're going to include every possible term that we can construct out of those parameters, and we're going to take a linear combination of them. The problem is that there are, in principle, infinitely many possible terms if you include derivatives. So you could take a 10,000th derivative of something, and that could apply as of now, because we haven't really said anything that would preclude you from including a term like that. Okay, so we're going to make some assumptions to try to eliminate those sorts of things. The first of these is that we have some macroscopic system. It makes sense to apply sort of thermodynamic arguments. We want to specify that we're near equilibrium in some sense, so it makes sense to use these parameters at all. And then secondly, we're going to assume that local fluctuations in these parameters are small. This is essentially the same statement as before, that you're near equilibrium in some sense, because in equilibrium, everything is constant, nothing is flowing or moving. So the statement that local fluctuations in these parameters are small is the same as saying that they're almost constant, and something that's almost constant, derivatives of that thing are very small as well. So we're going to suppose that derivative terms are small and that higher derivatives are getting smaller and smaller. So this sort of approach precludes having a 10,000th derivative appearing at low order. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to stratify our definition order by order in essentially gradients. And the one nuance here is that, so at zeroth order, you have no derivative terms. At first order, you have first derivative terms. But at second order, we're going to count second derivatives and products of first derivatives as both second order. Okay, that's the only real nuance. And the idea is you can actually get a definition for your stress energy tensor in terms of these parameters, which has finitely many terms, by truncating the series at some given order. All right? So before we actually define one of these theories, it's conventional to write your stress energy tensor in a particular way. So it's conventional to decompose it and project it into pieces with respect to sort of the relationship to the flow for velocity, here U. And what this does is we essentially write one scalar piece, which is parallel to U in both indices, that's at E. We have one scalar piece, which is orthogonal in both indices, which is done using this delta tensor, which is orthogonal to the flow velocity in both indices. We have this Q term, which is orthogonal in its index, but the U is parallel. So you have a parallel orthogonal mixed piece, and then the same thing with flipped indices. And then the sort of calligraphy T is a term that is orthogonal in both indices, but is also traceless. Whereas that P term with that delta, that's orthogonal in both indices, but it has a trace. Okay, so this is just a way of splitting the stress energy tensor, and this is generic. You can do this in general. So this E and P are scalars, Q is a vector that's orthogonal to the flow velocity, and this thing T, when I say transverse here, I mean that it's orthogonal in both indices, so it's a transverse traceless 2 tensor. And this is completely general. So you can do this for any symmetric 2 tensor as long as you have one of these time-like 4 vectors. Okay? So this is just a way of writing it, just a bookkeeping system. So using this bookkeeping system, we're going to write down the zeroth order theory. When I say zeroth order, I mean zeroth order in gradients. So that involves writing down a zero derivative function of epsilon and U. And it turns out when you write out all the possible scalars, you really just have a scalar function of epsilon. Turns out there are no vector terms you can write down out of those components, which are also orthogonal to U. And there are no transverse traceless 2 tensors that you can write down either. So you make some rest frame arguments to fix what that scalar function has to be, and you get the perfect fluid. So the piece that curly E is just epsilon, it's just the equilibrium energy density. And then that piece that's orthogonal in both indices, that's just the pressure. And that's a function of the energy density because of the fact that we've assumed everything is conformal. And in particular, it's a specific function. If you're in a four-dimensional space-time, you get that it has to be epsilon over 3. Okay.
I have a question. U squared is normalized to minus 1, right?
Yes, that's true.
Otherwise, another scalar.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, so this is ideal hydrodynamics, zeroth order in gradients. That's just a repeat of the same thing. The equations of motion are given by the fact that the divergence of this thing is 0, and those equations are called the relativistic Euler equations. And the relativistic Euler equations are the most common relativistic hydro theory for applications to astrophysics. Okay, and in that regard, that means that dissipative effects, which appear at higher order in gradients, which we'll get to in a second, are not usually considered. So at zeroth order, we have insensitivity to these gradient effects. And specifically, that means that we can't account for viscosity, which is a transfer of momentum due to velocity gradients. And we can't account for heat conduction, which is a transfer of heat energy due to temperature gradients. Okay? And those are sort of the goals. So we have to go to higher order in gradients if we want to accommodate those things. All right? So now we're going to play this. Yes?
Just a question on the choice of words. So you said insensitive, but the evolution will be sensitive to gradient. So insensitive, you mean at the formal kind of write up level, is that what you're saying?
So
I just want to ask, what do you mean insensitive?
Yeah, so when I say insensitive, I mean that your stress energy tensor is not a sort of assigning an energy cost to gradients. Your actual equations of motion are taking a gradient or taking a divergence of stress energy. So you will have derivatives in that. Does that answer the question?
Okay,
so now we're going to play this game at first order in gradients. We do the exact same thing.
Can I ask you a stupid question before you go ahead? This is really stupid, but is it obvious that you should count epsilon and UA as the parameters for the expansion? I mean, because you know there are systems in which the dispersive relation is non-trivial, so you might say that epsilon T, I mean, the variables are not necessarily related in a simple way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what is the fundamental principle in defining epsilon UA as the parameters for this?
So you have some freedom to choose other parameters, which are related by the laws of thermodynamics. So I could express this entirely in terms of a temperature and a chemical potential if I wanted to.
Is it obvious that thermodynamics should be postulated rather than derived from a fluid?
That's a great question.
Because if you define a stress current properly for the four vector stress current, four vector entropy current, you can derive from the perfect fluid the laws of thermodynamics if this entropy current has some properties. So you can essentially, a priori find the laws of thermodynamics from the conservation of the entropy current if you require the entropy current to have certain properties. So some people, like Coptus, since you mentioned, had a paper in which he derives the law of thermodynamics of leading order. So I was wondering, why do you assume that? Why do you say that epsilon and t are counting as only one variable rather than two in the expansion to begin with, and then find they are related?
That's a good question. I'll have to think about that a bit.
Okay. I'll come back
to you. I have to think about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we're gonna work on doing this up to first order ingredients. We're gonna define a stress energy tensor, and this process is essentially taking first order gradients of these two parameters, and at this order we have the zeroth order pieces, which are epsilon, and this pressure, which is a function of epsilon, and you also have these two one derivative terms. Okay, and these turn out to be the only two other terms that you can construct, which are scalars. Okay, now if you look at this vector piece, which is orthogonal to the flow velocity, there are two vectors you can construct. Okay, and finally, if you look at this transverse traceless two tensor, it turns out there's only one of those, which is called the shear tensor, and that has kind of a complicated definition, which is essentially proportional to gradients of the flow velocity, and it's sort of the unique transverse traceless two tensor composed of those gradients. And I'm just going to leave it as this and not define it, but I can find the definition for you, write it down if you want. But in essence, the idea is that this approach, what we're going to do is we're going to take a general linear combination, and that will give us conformal BDNK theory. And that's what I'm going to sort of talk about for the rest of the talk. And when I say linear combination, I mean that we have some set of coefficients weighting all of these derivative terms. Okay? These are usually called transport coefficients, and then things like conformal symmetry and thermodynamics sort of ensure that these things are not always all independent. Okay? So again, we're sticking with this decomposition, and we can see that these scalars have that perfect fluid piece. So the perfect fluid stress energy tensor is included in the BDNK stress energy tensor. And then there are some other corrections, which are kind of hidden by a box here. And you can see that these two scalar terms, they incorporate all of the other scalar derivative corrections. We have now a vector piece, which has those two vector corrections. And we have that transverse traceless tensor piece appearing as well. So if you look into what these are, so you can see we have a gradient correction to the energy density and the pressure. We have what's now a heat flux vector, this vector term. And then we have a shear viscosity term. Okay.
Just a question, is there any reason the coefficients are fixed inside the parentheses?
Yeah, so I think that this comes out of conformal symmetry. I believe that's the case here. So if you require that your stress energy tensor is traceless, you get these. So notice that we haven't pulled anything out from under a rug. These are precisely those five gradient terms I mentioned before. And we have three of these transport coefficients instead of the full five because they're related. Some of them are related due to conformal symmetry. And of these, I have a tau epsilon, which weights gradient corrections to the energy density and the pressure. Tau q is sort of weights the size of this heat flux vector. And then this thing eta, which is defined with the minus two out front just conventionally, this is a shear viscosity. Okay?
What's p?
Sorry?
What's p?
Sorry, p is just this equilibrium pressure. So it's epsilon over 3 for a conformal fluid.
I mean the one inside the parentheses. Not calligraphy.
Yeah, so the calligraphy P is that full.
Yes. The capital P inside?
The capital P is just epsilon over 3. It's the equilibrium.
Ah, it's epsilon over 3.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not independent.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
Was that the question earlier?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, well.
Okay, sorry, I might have misunderstood your previous question. Yeah, so this P, just a non-calligraphy P, is just epsilon over 3. It's just the equation of state for a conformal fluid.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so that was the theory, and I'm going to... Oh, sorry.
I think you mentioned this, but the bulk viscosity coefficient has been identified with the coefficient on the gradient of the energy density.
Mm-hmm.
And is that due to the symmetry, is that what requires that? Is normally those things could be independent.
Sorry, are you shear viscosity?
It's your calibrated E.
Yes.
A single coefficient.
Yes.
That's on both the gradient of the energy density and the bulk viscosity.
So for a conformal fluid, there's no bulk viscosity. So bulk appears as essentially a trace piece. It appears in the trace of the stress energy tensor. If you assert that's trace free, then it shouldn't appear. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, was there another question?
Yes. So, I'm a bit confused about what is the definition of UA here, because I would have thought that you go to the rest frame of the fluid and then that defines UA. But then, if I define it that way, then there shouldn't be a QA there, because QA is basically the energy flux in the rest frame of the fluid. So, I'm kind of confused about what is the definition of UA.
Okay, so this is one of the nuances that I'll get to. In essence, because we're looking at a theory which is allowed to be outside of thermodynamic equilibrium, the definitions of these parameters is not unique. It's essentially just a parameter. It has to become unique when you approach equilibrium, because there's a unique equilibrium definition which is actually a physical observable. But outside of equilibrium, it's not. So I'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so I'm going to talk about properties now of this theory. It's the name of the authors. It's Benfica, Disconzi, Neronia, and Kofton. And I can repeat that again. It's sort of like a new thing, so the acronym is also new. So the way that I want to discuss these properties is I want to start by considering the energy density seen by a co-moving observer, which is just this calligraphy E from that previous theory, which kind of motivates using that decomposition because it makes things like this easy. And you have this. Now, if you look at this thing, there are sort of two clear pieces. There's epsilon, which is just that perfect fluid bit, the equilibrium energy density. And then you have a beyond equilibrium correction, which has gradient terms. And from this, you can see immediately, and I think I might have phrased this a little bit confusingly, the presence of this second term means that that's non-zero when you're outside of equilibrium. When that thing goes to zero, you have the observed energy density is just the equilibrium energy density, epsilon. Okay? So when things approach equilibrium, you get the perfect fluid back. And consequently, when you're outside of equilibrium, you have a gradient correction.
So at zeroth order, if you just take the zeroth order, what does the thing in parentheses do on shell?
It evaluates to zero. And I'll talk about that later. I'd probably ask me a question if I don't get to that. Yes?
People talk about
have you subtleties the definition of the fork velocity?
Yeah.
And here you say the fork velocity for an observer coping with the flow. You're like assuming what the fork velocity means. So are you going to talk about that?
I'll talk about that more.
Okay.
I'll get to that. So in this case, you can see that this E is a physical observable. You should be able to measure this. That means that the right-hand side is as well. So if these gradient corrections are non-zero, that means that whole thing is a physical observable, and epsilon on its own is not. So this statement is just saying that the definition of things like epsilon and U outside of equilibrium is not unique, and they only reach their unique equilibrium definition when you equilibrate. Okay. So this is consistent with the fact that there are no first principle definitions for these things outside of equilibrium, and that sort of leads to all the nuances that I'm going to talk about. It results in a lot of tricky little things. Okay. Now, we're going to try to address that fact by considering field redefinitions of those parameters. I mentioned that they're not unique. You should be able to field redefine them into something else, which is physically equivalent. Okay? So that's what we're going to do here, using the same example of the co-moving energy density. We're going to consider this kind of messy field redefinition. Now, notice that this epsilon prime, this new energy density that we're defining, is the same at zeroth order, but it has some gradient correction, which is precisely that same term up there, except instead of that tau epsilon, I've put in X, which is just something. Okay? Now, if you take a gradient of this definition here of epsilon prime, you find that the gradient is equal to that of epsilon plus something that is second order in gradients. Okay? So like a derivative of this term in brackets, that thing is already a first order in derivatives, the derivative of that is second order. And the thing is, we're only defining this theory up to first order in gradients. So that second order piece gets dropped. Okay, so these derivatives are the same. And when you do that algebra, you sub that in and you express that, that physical observable, the observed energy density, in terms of this new parameter, you get this thing. And you find that everything is exactly the same except for that coefficient. Okay? So another way of phrasing this is that the out-of-equilibrium definition for the energy density in this case is determined by that coefficient on that gradient correction. Okay? All right. So this is where all of the nuances come. So BDNK theory, conformal BDNK theory specifically, has three of these transport coefficients, these two taus and this thing eta. Of these, the two taus will change under field redefinitions of these parameters outside of equilibrium. In equilibrium, all these definitions become the same. They become the equilibrium version. But outside, field redefinitions will change these transport coefficients. Turns out that the other coefficient is invariant under these field redefinitions. And that's important because this is actually a physical thing. This is the shear viscosity. Right? So in this respect, it seems like these transport coefficients tau epsilon and tau q, they're sort of just choosing this sort of arbitrary out of equilibrium definition for your parameters. And because of that, this is typically called the choice for hydrodynamic frame. Okay? It's sort of like how you're viewing your system outside of equilibrium. It shouldn't really impact the physics.
Sorry.
Yes.
So is there like a physical way to interpret this hydrodynamic frame, or is it just a formal way of referring to it?
So at the moment, without sort of betraying what's on the next slides, I'm going to say, based on what I've said so far, it seems like you can choose anything. Okay, but I'll update that in a second. Okay, was there another question?
Yeah, I just couldn't ask whether you can just set them in zero.
That's a great question. It also will be coming soon. So can we set them to whatever we want? Exactly predicted the question.
Yeah. Not yet to worry about relativistic dynamics. You can't do that freely, right?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
So I've titled this Hydroframes and Pathologies. So let's go back to my toy example here, which is the observed energy density. And let's take a really simple case. Let's pick flat space-time, no flow velocity, and Cartesian coordinates. Okay, you can do that. And you can essentially just plug that into the stuff on the top. And you get that thing there. You find that you get the epsilon is the same. And then you have tau epsilon. And that first derivative bit, that becomes the epsilon dt. And that second bit, because we assume the flow velocity is zero, that gradient vanishes. You can rearrange this, solve for d epsilon dt. And if you're familiar with this business, you'll see this is a relaxation equation. And what this essentially does is if epsilon and e are different, which will happen outside of equilibrium, what this does is it forces those things to be the same. So if, for example, if epsilon is bigger than the observed energy density e, that derivative is negative, and d e dt shrinks it so that it reaches e.
You have to choose a sign for tau.
Yes. Now that relies on tau being positive. And if tau is negative, that means that instead of equilibrating, this thing blows up. Okay, so it looks like, you know, before it seemed like the choice for tau didn't really matter at all. Now it's clear that, okay, well, maybe something will go wrong if you choose bad values. There's another instance which is interesting. So if you take the limit of tau to zero, this thing will how fast it will equilibrate depends on how big tau is. So if you take that to zero, your system looks like it's equilibrating instantly, which sounds bad for a relativistic theory because you have some kind of causal bound on how fast things can do things. Okay?
But there is also in the Israeli Stewart formulation, there is the story that you need to go to second order to have causality, right?
So that is the claim originally.
Yeah.
And
the correct claim.
So what BDNK claims is that at first order, you can actually recover those properties you need, stability and causality, yeah, among others, at first order.
Yeah.
And the way this is done by accounting for the fact that you can't use a Landau or Eckhart frame.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll give a little bit of a summary. And again, you guys are predicting the next slide. Exactly. So outside of equilibrium, these parameters don't have unique definitions. The precise definition depends on those transport coefficients you choose, the choice for which defines your hydrodynamic frame. And in conformal BDNK, there are three of these transport coefficients. Two of these change with field redefinitions, and in that sense, they're sort of pure frame. Their choice doesn't really have any clear physical meaning. And one of them does have a clear physical meaning, and it's framed frame choice invariant, and that's eta, which is a shear viscosity. So it turns out the claim of BDNK is that the choice of these frame coefficients determines if your theory is causal and stable. And when I say stable, I mean that your equilibrium state is stable. Okay. Now I have a little bit of a historical aside here, which sort of addresses the things that I mentioned before. There were some original formulations of relativistic dissipative hydrodynamics in the 40s and 50s by Eckhart and Landau-Lischitz. And each of them, they don't account for this 0.3c, that you have to actually care what you choose for tau epsilon and tau q. And they set it to zero, which is sort of the natural thing, right? You want to simplify the equations as much as you can. But if you do this, it was shown in the 80s by Hiscock and Lindblom, that the theory is acausal and badly unstable. And the classic example, which provides a good anecdote, is that if you solve for the evolution of water perturbed about equilibrium at standard temperature and pressure, it blows up at a time scale 10 to the minus 34 seconds. So these theories are really badly broken. And the claim is that you can fix them just by choosing better values for these tau epsilon and tau q. Okay? So this is sort of the motivation for using this BDNK approach. They account for this hydrodynamic frame, and because of that, they're able to rigorously prove in the nonlinear regime for a lot of these things that the theory is causal, strongly hyperbolic, locally well posed, and that the thermodynamic equilibrium state is linearly stable. Proofs in generality of these properties don't exist for things like Miller-Israel-Stewart. And almost all of those, some of them are second order gradient theories, but almost all of those at first order will choose an Eckhart or Landau frame. So they'll set essentially something like this. They'll set the gradient correction to the energy density to zero. Okay? But they use a different method to sort of save you. You save yourself by sort of asserting that you have those relaxation equations for some additional degrees of freedom.
I have a question.
Yes.
How initial value problem has been resolved in this?
Not sure exactly what you mean by that. Sorry.
It is a strong hyperbolicity, right? This strong hyperbolicity refers to the initial value problem.
Yes.
And how you have resolved it?
So
this model.
Sorry?
How you resolve this problem using this model?
This is not my work personally. This is work of these authors, BDNK. Essentially they view these as second order PDEs in these parameters I've mentioned, and they've been able to prove this. I'm not sure about I don't remember the details of that off the top of my head, sorry.
All right, thank you.
I can link papers if that's interesting. Yes.
So I'm not sure, but I think there are proofs in the Eckhart-Landau frame for a second order. I think
yes.
And just a comment because this gets lost when you read paper. So the local process proof of this theory is, as we talked yesterday, in a slightly weaker sense than the standard one. So. What that means, I don't know yet, but it's a slightly weaker sense.
I have one more claim. I actually was going to try to find you. Okay. So there was an original paper where they worked out this conformal BDNK theory in 2018, and they proved local well-posedness in what are called Givray spaces. I'm not an expert on the math by any means, but there is a more recent paper which came out in 2021 or 2 where they upgrade this to Sobolev spaces.
Okay.
So that is the claim in the paper. And then also there was a causality of Israel-Stewart, I think that got mentioned. That was also worked out. If you look at sort of standard Israel-Stewart, you get essentially a statement about some frame constraints that you need to satisfy in order to have a causal theory. And that's a little bit harder to do in those theories than this one. I can talk about that later if you're interested. Okay? So our goal here is to take advantage of this really nice mathematical foundation and then apply BDNK in a context where relativistic dissipative fluid effects are not really accounted for, and specifically that's astrophysics problems, including this binary neutron star merger problem I mentioned before. Okay? So now I'm going to talk about my own work, progress toward these astro applications. And here I have a little bit of a roadmap of things that we've done. The first thing of this list was that we did sort of the first numerical solve of the BDNK PDEs in this conformal context, and I'll kind of overview what we did here. The idea was we found this theory and we wanted to solve the PDEs, so it's natural to start with the simplest possible case, so a system of 1 plus 1D PDEs, and we wanted to compare them to ideal hydrodynamics and also toy model version of that Muller-Israel-Stewart theory so that we could see just if they're giving us sensible solutions. Okay? So this was done for a conformal fluid in flat space-time and planar symmetry, so the whole system varies only in time and in one spatial direction. So the simplest possible setup. And we also wanted to use sort of a simple numerical method. So what we did is we used just a finite difference method for these viscous terms. And the only thing that about that that's really important for this talk is that there is some assumption of smoothness that goes into using a finite difference method. And for fluid equations, you're not guaranteed that your solutions are always smooth. So that will come up. So fortunately, if you choose smooth solutions, you're OK with this sort of finite difference method. We find that the solutions are indeed sensible, so they agree with this toy model of Israel-Stewart. And if you turn the viscosity off, you find that they agree with the perfect fluid. So sanity checks sort of work, and here I have some Gaussian in the energy density, which sort of splits and gets dissipated, so the profile kind of widens. And the most interesting thing, I think, of this paper was that if you choose a good hydrodynamic frame, you always have shockwave solutions, which exist and are smooth. This is not true for the classical formulation of Muller-Israel-Stewart, where it was shown in the 80s that if you're looking at shockwave solutions that are fast enough, they break down in some respect. Okay, so here I have some additional data sort of approximating a planar shockwave, but we're in the rest frame. So the little error in the initial data versus the actual time-independent solution propagates off, and you get something time-independent. Okay, so after doing that, I mentioned that our numerical method was not the best thing that it could be. So the next thing that we decided to work on was to make a suitable numerical method. And when you talk about numerics for fluid theories, people usually are thinking about shocks. So the physics definition of a shock that I'm going to use here is that shocks form when you have some flow that exceeds the local sound speed. And here I have a picture of a bullet, and there are some shock waves coming off of that. And these things are characterized typically by a sharp variation in the state of the flow. So the temperature or the density might be very different as you cross this very small region. And even worse, if you're looking at ideal hydro, the theory doesn't have enough physics to define what that transition is in the shockwave. So it's modeled as a discontinuous step function. Now, if you have viscosity, that should be able to smooth out the shockwave. But the thing is, this theory will always have some limit where you smoothly turn off the viscosity. So it's either you write a solver that can't account for the fact that it has this inviscid limit, or you account for the inviscid limit and you write a solver that can handle the non-smooth solutions. So this is sort of the motivation. We wanted a shock capturing method. And before, I mentioned that I had this finite difference method. And one question is, why don't those sorts of methods work? Why do you need something special to handle these non-smooth solutions? The standard example of this is the inviscid Berger's equation here, which is sort of a fluid-like equation that forms shocks dynamically. And a nice test that you can use to illustrate this fact is you take some smooth initial data. So here I have a Gaussian in this value, in this variable Q. And I have a finite difference method in the red dots, and then a conservative finite volume method, so a shock capturing method in the red and the black line. And if you watch this thing evolve, the black line captures the fact that this forms a sharp shock wave. But your finite difference method just kind of goes crazy. It forms these spurious oscillations, and it completely fails to capture that shock front. So the method doesn't work because the method assumes smoothness, and here you don't have that. Okay, and these spurious oscillations are really sort of a very common occurrence if you have that sort of problem appear in your solution. Okay, so we want to make a method sort of like this black curve. And that's essentially what we did for BDNK. We have a high-resolution shock capturing finite volume method. This is sort of an expert's overview of the details of this method. It's flux conservative, it uses a non-oscillatory reconstruction for the primitive variables, and in that inviscid limit, it reduces to a modern perfect fluid solver. Okay, so it actually can handle you turning the viscosity off, which is good. And it's kind of a non-trivial thing for technical reasons. We tested this method on a series of problems, again, in flat space-time Cartesian coordinates for a conformal fluid, but the structure of the equations is the same there versus in the general case. So the method should still work when you relax these assumptions. All right, so the first classical problem we wanted to look at with the shock capturing method is this 1D shock tube. So you set up some discontinuous initial data here in the energy density. And this is sort of what it does. The high energy density region kind of feeds flow into the low energy density region. And remember that the old method should break down like these red dots, whereas the new method should behave like the black curve. And that's sort of precisely what we see. So the old method is shown here on the left, and it's prone to these spurious oscillations. And the right curve actually has a stable, reasonable evolution. Yes.
Sorry, there was a bunch of words there, so I'm not sure. Did you, so there are shell countering methods that you can get off the shelf.
Yes.
Is it in addition to grabbing one of those, whatever you like, off the shelf, but to also introduce something else on top, or are you using one of those? I'm not sure what.
There are some tweaks. There are some tweaks you have to do. You can use, so there's some aspects where you can use sort of an out-of-the-box, off-the-shelf method. One of these is, for example, you have to discretize the flux terms in a certain way, and we use a method called the Kurganov-Tadmor method.
Sure.
But so it's just an off-the-shelf method. But there are things like this primitive variable solve, which is completely new, because you're using different primitive variables here.
Right, that's not the methods. That's the application, right? The method, you're still the algorithm is still the same. The conservative primitive, that's your choice. That's something, because you use a particular set of variables, because of the type of the equation of motions that you're dealing with, then you have some intricacies of implementation. But
okay.
So I wouldn't call conservative to primitive part of the shock capturing method. I mean, this is just a matter of terminology.
Yeah, yeah.
My choice of words, but your choice
okay.
would be that part of the method.
Yeah, so let me. I'll use your choice of words. So I would say that the algorithm is most definitely different from how it's applied for a perfect fluid. But there are aspects where sort of direct application of the perfect fluid sort of scheme will have to be tweaked. So you're using, in essence, the same rough numerical method, but there are little accommodations you have to make in the technical details of the implementation. Okay? Yes?
So these terms introduce second order time derivatives, right?
In your equations of motion, yes.
Yeah. So, how do you deal with this?
So, in essence, what we're doing is, in order to put it, so when you typically use one of these methods, you put it in your equations in conservative form, which is a first order conservation law, first order PDE. So we do essentially a first order reduction. We take components of the stress energy as our conserved variables, and now all of a sudden those components have derivatives in them.
Right.
So, for example, when you compute fluxes, there are time and space derivatives in the fluxes, and this is the way in which the implementation has to be different. And there are time and space derivatives in the conserved variables as well. But because you're essentially you're doing this first order reduction, you have to solve for the time derivatives when you do your primitive inversion. Okay.
Yeah.
Another question.
So when people do Navier-Stokes or things like that, I mean, do they have these same problems with using finite differences? Because I thought that was. People did use like high order finite difference stuff for non-relativistic.
My understanding of this, so really, if you are resolving the viscosity all the time, then everything should be smooth. So you should be able to get away with using methods that are based on this assumption of smoothness. We really just wanted, I mean, realistically, we really wanted to do this shock tube test. And we also know that there are cases physically where if you're solving some problem, the viscous scale is not going to be resolved. So you're going to effectively, even though the underlying continuum solution is smooth, at the numerical grid scale, you're going to have something that looks discontinuous. So you have to fight these spurious oscillations no matter what you do. Does that answer the question? Yes.
So, what's the problem with artificially boosting viscosity? So basically, artificial numerical viscosity, just add that. And I mean, most of the time, it doesn't matter except where you have this.
That are smooth, so. Uh-huh. So you're asking why not use an artificial viscosity method? So in one respect, you could say, it depends. So you could do that, I think. I think that would also be a possibility. That in general, that's going to be more dispersive, as you were saying. It'll smooth out things a bit more than it should here. You could do this, though. And it may end up being that works perfectly fine for applications. But I think that this is sort of the more nuanced method that may give you slightly more accuracy in the case where you form shocks. You actually do get sharper shock resolution and things like that. So that was kind of why. I don't think that there's necessarily that you have to have this kind of method.
Well, it would depend on the time scale you're interested in. That's how artificial viscosity would artificially kill your problem.
Yeah. Okay. That was the 1D test. You can also do a 2D test where you form some shockwave. And furthermore, in 2D, you can form a shockwave which is not aligned with your numerical grid, which is even a harder code test. So that's what we did here. We have some sort of setup where you sort of form a really high energy density curved region. And the edge of this region, because this is the log of the energy density, the edge of this region is bounded by some curved kind of almond-shaped shockwave. And this is sort of a good test of whether or not this is able to handle structures like this. This method can handle this without introducing those spurious oscillations. It's able to work relatively well. But of course, the point of doing these things is to break the code. And it breaks in precisely the same way that typical fluid solvers would break. If you have really high velocities or if you have really low densities, you'll end up over removing stuff from a region and you'll get negative densities and problems like that. Okay. Now, finally, the last thing I wanted to talk about out of these code tests was essentially a problem where we can smoothly turn the viscosity off and check that our solver actually works in that limit, because that's a really good test case for no matter what application you're considering. So here we have something something like an astrophysical jet here in the gray, which flows and has two interfaces with some ambient medium. And we seed those ambient media interfaces with a little perturbation, and that grows as a result of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And what you actually see physically is that you'll get a vortex, and the size of this vortex will depend strongly on the viscosity. Okay, so here is an inviscid simulation showing vortex formation, and you can see that it really mixes a bunch, and it looks kind of it looks inviscid. It looks like it isn't very thick. You turn on the viscosity, and so that case I was showing you before is the top left panel, and as you move to the right, you increase viscosity, and you can see that that vortex gets damped out, and most importantly, that you can smoothly resolve these cases as you turn the viscosity off. And then the bottom row is just the same things, but at a later time. Okay. So now I'll talk about really quickly. I mentioned before everything was in the conformal fluid limit. It was kind of nice in the sense that it simplifies things quite a bit. Decouples stress energy from the particle current. It fixes your equation of state to be this very nice little simple thing. And there's only really one legitimate dissipative effect, which is just the shear viscosity. That's great, but that's not general. And that simplicity comes at the cost of killing your bulk viscosity, which is what we want for this binary neutron star merger problem, and also heat conduction. So we had to generalize to a non-conformal theory. And essentially what this amounts to doing is picking some microphysics, deriving a set of coefficients, and then checking that those coefficients are suitable and allow you to use those proofs of the reasonable properties of BDNK theory. So you have to choose coefficients that allow you to have a theory that's causal, strongly hyperbolic, well-posed, and so forth. Okay, so we did this for this gamma law equation of state. This is sort of typical in some toy models of astro problems.
What is it? Epsilon minus Mn?
Yeah, so M is just like a particle mass, and N is the particle density. Okay, so this is sort of it's typically written in a different way.
One particle model.
Yeah, it's one species. Yeah, it's just the constant.
Just a question about that comment that only has one dissipative effect here, viscosity. But if you take the FNK, whatever, and you compute the entropy growth, right, the entropy growth will still be positive even if I choose the shear viscosity at zero by virtue of the tau, E, and Q, right? Or so if I compute that. The entropy, would I have it strictly positive because the tau are not zero?
That's a great question. So I think that, okay, so there are a couple statements you can make. So first of all, if you turn off the shear viscosity, actually, so I think that the answer to this is you can't really turn off the shear viscosity and have a reasonable theory. So when you do that, you violate all of those properties that I mentioned before.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if I just look at the entropy, I don't even know what you need.
Yeah.
And you just break the limit of eta to zero. And you don't look at the other things you're introducing. Uh-huh. Do you still have, and what I'm saying is, whether the choice of variables in the structure now has kind of hidden in it some other dissipative thing built in? I don't know.
I want to say no, but I don't know for sure. And in fact, I think that in this case, those other parameters end up being proportional to the shear viscosity. I'm not sure if that's a requirement of conformal symmetry or a requirement of those proofs I mentioned, but we can talk about that after. Okay, so we did this. And now we're working on solving this with that microphysics I mentioned before, outside of conformal symmetry, and also coupled to gravity. So everything we've done so far has been in flat space-time, so I'm barely qualifying myself to talk at the strong gravity seminar with this thing here. So what we're currently doing is a BDNK fluid coupled to gravity and spherical symmetry. And there are some sort of preliminary challenges. I haven't had that much time to work on this yet, but it'll have to get done. It's going into thesis. So these covariant derivatives you put into the stress energy tensor, they introduce metric derivative terms into your stress energy tensor. So for example, the heat flux has these nasty Christoffel symbols which pop up. In principle, this shouldn't really be a problem because you can use the Einstein equations to eliminate these. But practically, the actual problem that I'm facing is that this thing will introduce factors of 1 over the radius. And numerically, that causes a lot of issues with the origin. So this is sort of what I'm fighting right now. But I think that this should be resolvable, and we should soon be able to have sort of a spherical star code that has a BDNK fluid as its matter model. Okay. So now I'll quickly talk about future steps. I think I have like a minute. The end goal here of this sort of research plan was to look at a binary neutron star merger. And here we've laid most of the groundwork for that problem. The approach that we should take is not to reinvent the entire wheel. We want to just write essentially a BDNK fluid module for some existing binary merger code. And once that's done, we can sort of study the impact of these dissipative effects, like bulk viscosity, which has some physical motivation, on the gravitational wave signal. Okay. There are a lot of additional like future steps after this. One of these, which is sort of well-motivated, is applying BDNK to model the quark-gluon plasma, because most applications, most modeling of the quark-gluon plasma uses that DNMR theory I mentioned before. It would be really nice to try to see how sort of the nuances in formulating that theory have impacted what we predict for the physics by comparing against something that's formulated in a different way. Okay. There is an extension that exists to include electromagnetic fields, so a theory that is relativistic dissipative magnetohydrodynamics, which exists and is based in this BDNK formalism, but it hasn't been applied to anything yet. And I would really like to try to apply that to study black hole accretion disks, because there are some indications that black hole accretion disks have some viscosity acting there, and these electromagnetic fields are very clearly strong in that case as well. Okay, so that's basically it. Here's a summary. I'll quickly read some of it. I think that BDNK is a promising approach for incorporating this first-order dissipation, so first-order gradients, into these relativistic fluid models, largely because of those nice math properties. We made some progress toward an ASTER application. We solved the equations, we developed a numerical scheme, and then we generalized outside of that conformal fluid limit. And now we're working on finally coupling it to gravity. And because of sort of how hydro is, there are a bunch of possible additional applications. Just owing to the fact that hydro on its own is very widely applicable. So I think those things are exciting. That's basically it. So thank you.
Yeah. Can I ask you just a final question?
Sure.
Thanks for bearing with all the questions.
Sorry.
So when you were talking about the relativistic magnetohydrodynamics as applied for gluon plasmas, I guess you meant in the framework of BDNK, right? Because there are previous works by Rezola, by Zanelli, which they were trying to do this using Israeli Stewart theories, right?
Yeah.
So you mean in the framework of BDNK?
Yes, yes. I mean, there is a BDNK base, so first order in gradients.
Okay, yeah, I see. Thanks. Okay, yeah, I agree that that's not been done. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else? Yes.
What about neutrinos?
Ah, okay. Found the Achilles heel. So in this binary neutron star merger problem, the bulk viscosity is sort of caused by neutrinos. So the idea is if you have neutrinos, you don't need bulk viscosity necessarily. But my understanding is that the implementation of neutrinos is not sort of totally set in stone. So there's some leeway in the neutrino physics. And if you were to do it using this sort of effective approach, you really have a nice knob on turning on and off the viscosity to if you want to study how sort of the bulk dynamics of the system will behave as a result of that kind of effect. So, yeah.
So can you say a little bit more about the extra complexity that goes from going from the conformal fluid to the non-conformal one? Is it just more terms that you have to choose from the microphysics, or
yeah,
extra complications there?
In essence, so you gain more physics, you gain bulk viscosity and heat conductivity, and you also gain two more of those sort of, actually one more of those sort of frame-only coefficients. As far as the structure of the equations, outside of the conformal limit, you now couple your baryon current, if that's what you have, whatever particle current you have, now back reacts on your stress energy. So you have an additional equation you have to care about. other complications? There are, I don't think there are really other complications, but there are new solutions you can have. There are, for example, you can study heat propagation. So in the conformal fluid case, anytime you have a temperature gradient, turns out that the pressure goes like T to the fourth. So if you set up a temperature gradient, you always also have a pressure gradient in particles flow. But for a non-conformal fluid, those things are not dependent on each other. You can set up a temperature gradient where particles don't flow and heat only flows. So you can study what happens in heat flow. And an interesting sort of minor aside is that in the non-relativistic case, you just get a heat equation for propagation of heat. In this case, you get the relativistic generalization, which is a telegrapher's equation. It's a damped wave equation. And then if you work this out for BDNK, you get that, but with additional lower order terms. So there are additional solutions that I think are interesting. Yes? No problem.
So have you ever thought, since there is a lot of progress in the SCMT, have you ever thought of applying these things to holographic setups where maybe you can find some gravity dwarfs of quark gluon plasmas? Because BDNK is ready made to be applied in the SCMT. There are works that I, but also a lot of other people before me, have done doing that. Mm-hmm. It's very naturally applies there. And there's actually a way which you can see holographically that the frame, hydrodynamic frame, that you may want to choose randomly as an effect.
Oh.
So you see it from the point of view of gravity in the back, which is dual. It's not just a gravitational system with fluids on it. It's just a completely different system. So you compute some conserved quantities, and they are sensitive to the frame.
Oh.
It was actually not trivial to show that. And it's very nice, I believe, because now you're saying that intrinsically in the fluids. So it's very nice that kind of agree with the fact that you cannot just redefine things randomly in this parametric expansion. So I was thinking maybe, you know, since now you know fluids better, if you go back to that holographic story, maybe you can learn better gravity on the other side.
I think that would be definitely interesting. There is one paper I know of that uses BDNK and then talks about holography, but I don't know the specifics of that paper in great detail. But yeah, I definitely do agree that would be quite an interesting to do.
Any other questions? Oh, if not, let's send it.